Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist.
And I'm Kate Hensler, developmental interventionist. How are you tonight, Laura?
I'm really tired. How are you?
You had a very, very busy week, didn't you?
I did. I've been home all of 10 minutes, too, so nothing like,
oh,
you know, just running in the door. But I can't think of a better way than to wrap up a great week than have a show. And let me tell you, we have some friends in Louisiana, Kate.
Oh.
They listen to the show. And we had one wonderful woman come from Houston, Texas, to Lafayette, Louisiana, and she was so sweet and so funny. And she said, I knew it was you when she came around the corner. I think she heard me talking because she listens to the podcast all the time. It's very funny. She didn't say this, but a lot of people will say, you sound just like you do on the podcast. And I always think that's the funniest thing ever. So it
was
fun.
They ask you about your northerner friend? Who's that northerner you do that show with?
No, they would say, tell Kate hi. Hey, tell Kate hello. Where's Kate?
And I hope you said, Kate doesn't like to think that people really listen, so I can't tell her any of that.
I do tell people that.
The conversation we have on Sundays related to our favorite topic, communication in early childhood. That's about it.
I know.
No, I didn't get to talk to Laura all week because she was so busy. How'd your conferences go for real?
For real, they went great. They went great. We had a lot of fun. New Orleans is always fun. You know, I always come back from Louisiana and say, I'm moving there. But it was a lot of fun. Lafayette was great, too. Just a lot of fun. And they were. And both days, I had folks that had come to the conferences last year, and they were repeaters and came. And, you know, I tweaked the conference nearly after every single session, and so the outline is the same. There's still different stories and new footage that I add or better examples, and so it was good. I recognized people, and you know that kind of freaks people out too, because you know how I am about names and faces. I can usually remember where I've seen you before when I see someone, and so that was kind of funny for people. So anyway, it was a lot of fun, and I'm rambling. Let's just move right along to what we're supposed to be talking about tonight.
Okay. We're finally
before
getting
I do
to
that,
our topic. Oh, go ahead.
Before we do that, I do want to say last conference of the fall roadshow, the fall three-week tour, is this Thursday in Indianapolis. And if you have not already registered, I am so sorry. We are beyond sold out. That's another little issue I'm going to have to solve in the morning, figuring out how I can get a few more seats in that room. But I'm so excited about that. I love Indianapolis. I know there are going to be some people there that I met last year. That was my very first conference when I was still really scared. So it'll be really exciting to see those people too. And Indiana's your home, so it'll
That's
be like
right.
Kate's stomping ground.
In
so,
these parts,
yeah.
I'm kidding. Well, I'm from northern Indiana, which is considerably more northern than Indy, but I mean, as far as its kind of flavor, you know, culturally speaking.
Yeah.
But here people do tend to say, are you a northerner? Where are you from? Not, although not as much as they used to, so I must be losing some of my Chicago nasalness, but I do still get it on occasion. So.
And I saw a friend of mine from college last night, and they say that I don't sound Southern at all anymore.
You've lost your Southern
accent. Isn't that
funny? Yeah. And my family thinks I do sound Southern, so there you go. Yep.
We're blending. We're becoming one accent, Kate. We're both going to end up sounding the same.
I may have
I'm really
way
teasing
to
about that.
You should hear Bill's version of your accent, Laura. It's quite Southern. Whenever he says, when Laura said, it's like, real? I think she doesn't sound that Southern. But I guess to him, you do.
Oh, don't tell me that. Now I'm going to be self-conscious when I talk about
it. No, we like your accent. You've heard me say that a thousand times. But he does always make it Southern. And I think it's relative to my Northern, so there you go.
There you go. All right. Yeah. Okay, well, tonight, Let's move on, and I think you were going to talk about it. You want to go ahead and introduce tonight's topic because you started and I interrupted you about the indie stuff.
Yeah, you said let's get going, and then you gave one last thing about indie stuff.
Okay, yeah, and you know what? Now I've got to do one more thing.
Okay. Fine, go ahead.
I forgot to say Lexington. I've got to really talk about that. Lexington, Kentucky, that event, the last event of the year, is Friday, December 2nd, and I didn't mention that. And that registration is on the website. Last week when we did the show, it wasn't up yet, and so that's why I need to mention that tonight. And, again, I'm so tired, and I don't have my normal list, and that's the reason I'm forgetting all these things. Okay, now go on. Sorry about that. Go. Talk about tonight's show.
I'm not even sure I know how to introduce it, but I was trying to say we were finally getting to a topic that we tried to do a couple weeks ago, and then we got a caller, and then so we've kind of been off our intended schedule. But we had gotten, you had gotten a letter from a gal. This is how we're introducing it, right, with this letter?
Yeah.
And she apparently, this is the one we kind of made reference to because she was so cute about saying that she had five kids, and apparently she's a speech pathologist, but she stays at home with her kids right now. But she was the one joking about, she listens to the podcast when she nurses babies and cans peaches and cleans her basement. So we were chuckling about that. It's funny to us that anybody listens, let alone to hear what they actually do as they listen. But anyway, she had written to you about a situation, apparently maybe a neighbor. I don't know that I remember the details. In any case, she has been asked to kind of observe and give her opinion about some acquaintance's grandchild. The grandmother was concerned about the child's speech and language development, and she was kind of writing to you saying, gee, I really haven't had much experience yet. Yes, I have the degree. Here's what grandma's told me so far. And she kind of wanted some feedback from you before she dove right in and gave her opinion on this guy. But let's see, should we read it?
Yeah, and she was really concerned about looking at him, at his social skills, because we often don't get formal training as speech pathologists. And, Kate, did you have lots of formal training about assessing a child's social skills or interaction skills or his ability to, again, just be with other people? And she didn't have ways to really objectively analyze, and again, that she's not doing this formally. This is a favor for a dear friend, I think, from, I think the family's from church is how the reference, the personal relationship was. And so she's saying, tell me again, what do you think I should look for? And again, this is not during a formal assessment kind of thing, so we can be a little bit more casual about it. But as a group, for those of us who are early interventionists, whether we be speech pathologists or educators or occupational therapists, this is often something that we should do, that we're called upon to do, that we're professionally qualified to do, yet we don't have lots of points of reference about how to really effectively assess toddlers' social skills, or whatever you want to call it. Some tests call it co-regulated, pragmatic, blah, 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 blah.
Oh, my. Glad that's not my test. I wouldn't even know what they're talking about yet.
Yeah, but your test, tell us it's what your test, the kind of test that you use and what it's called on your test, and kind of a little overview from your perspective,
well,
Kate, as a developmental intervention.
Well, I still use the Hawaii Early Learning Profile, which I threatened to change because it's a pain in ways, but in a way it's a good assessment. It's a pain only to enter online, which is a new development for us. But anyway, it talks about it categorizes social skills into social-emotional skills, more domain, I should say. And it looks at, I would say you could still administer, I feel like you could administer this test and still not get a great grasp of how a child's doing socially, but it does certainly flag and question some of the big things. Does he wave bye-bye? Does he make consistent eye contact? Does he respond to his name when his name is called? Does he identify mommy and daddy? Of course, these are all at particular age ranges, but just kind of typical, you know, early baby up to three-year-old social kind of stuff. And I, like I said, I think those things are important, and they're certainly things we look at, but you asked me earlier if I'd gotten much training in social development, or, and the answer is no, very little, despite the fact that I have a master's degree that is supposed to allow me to do what I do. I think a lot of it, Laura, is something that you really do get better at, assuming you're doing the right things over time. And, you know, anymore I feel like I can walk in and pretty quickly have not a, a great read, but a pretty good read on a child's social skills just in the first couple minutes, you know, without even really trying to do much of anything. I feel like I have some pretty good idea of, you know, is this going to be a strength? Is this going to be an area of weakness? Is this something that I'm concerned about? And there are some kind of telltale things you can tell pretty quickly. But nobody ever taught me that exactly. I just kind of just learned it in the trenches. And, of course, we like to talk about this topic, so I've learned it from our conversations. Gosh, I can say over the years now, because it's now they've been recorded for years. That's a scary thought. But in any case, that's my assessment tool.
Yeah, and I use the Rossetti Infant Toddler Language Scale, which has, and lots of speech pathologists use that test. Dr. Rossetti, who developed this test, is an expert in birth to three and assessing children with communication delays and disorders in that age range. And there's a section on that test called interaction attachment, and you can certainly glean some very general generalized information about a child's social skills using that assessment. And then the other one that I really started to look at several years ago is the affect-based language curriculum, and it's a tool by Dr. Greenspan, Stanley Greenspan, and Diane Lewis. And it goes all the way up to the ripe old age of four, so a little bit beyond children that our listeners who are therapists might work with, because lots of folks who listen to us are just specialized in birth to three like we do, even though we may from time to time see a child past that age. And so that's a great test, and it is very particular. Those checklists are very, very specific about the kinds of skills you look at. But even before that, even before I found out about the affect-based language curriculum, I started looking just from assessment tool to assessment tool to assessment tool to see if, for me, I could really start to quantify and then look qualitatively at how we assess a child's social skills. Because like you said, Kate, after you have some clinical experience, you start to really feel like I can get a read on this without a checklist. However, there are lots of therapists who listen to us who aren't there yet, or who sometimes think that something's missing or something's off, but they just don't quite know what, you know, how to put their fingers on it. And I certainly remember feeling like that about lots of children when I first started to when we first started to get all those kids on our caseloads who, you know, everybody started looking a little bit like they were autistic. And for a long time, when I first started to practice, you didn't see as many autistic kids or kids who may go on to be diagnosed with autism as we do now. So it was kind of a shock to start to see more and more kids. And that's when I started really looking and thinking, can I put together a list for me so that I'll know that I'm covering the bases? Because a lot of times, again, we haven't had this as part of our formal education. It's the trial by fire knowledge that you get just from working with kids day in and day out and really assessing and then comparing the kids on your caseload to typically developing kids. And I know on this show and certainly in the conferences that I do, I talk about that I worked in my church's nursery, their preschool ministry, for a long time just so that I could remember that two-year-olds really talk. Because after your own children grow up and you're not around, typically developing two-year-olds, and your only point of reference becomes children who don't talk, it's sometimes a shock to hear a two-year-old who's really verbal. Or when we have children who don't easily interact, it's really sometimes a shock when we encounter typical development. And I think 2 weeks ago when we started to introduce the show, or maybe it was another show recently, it's all running together right now, we were talking about how almost unnerving it is, and I think this is what you said, Kate, when a typically developing baby really looks at you, whether you're in the grocery store or, you know, at Target or out to dinner, and you'll start to feel like, is somebody looking at me? And you'll look around, and it's an 18-month-old or a two-year-old, and they are staring you down. And it's again, sometimes it is quite shockingly different compared to some of the kids that we see on our caseload.
I get my dose of typical development when I see kids in a daycare and I stay in the classroom. I was in the classroom this week, and a little girl, I mean the girls especially, I don't know what, there just seem to be so much more outgoing or, you know, want attention more or something. But, of course, I'm there to see a boy, and girls were climbing all over me. One little girl was climbing on my lap and looking at my face, was just staring at my face. I thought, uh-oh, here it comes. She goes, what's on your lips? Of course, I have no lipstick.
Did you say, it's Revlon, candy, apple? Yeah.
I should have
wanted to know the shade of bread.
She was trying to tell me that she wore some. I said, do you wear Tapsy? She was trying to tell me that she, too, likes lipstick. So, anyway, it's pretty funny. But there's the difference. Of course, the guy I'm there to see, I'm trying to pull him over to, you know, to try and get him to engage with me and engage with the other kids. And meanwhile, I'm shooing three little girls off of my lap so that I can
you
get
were
over
clamoring.
To the kids I'm trying to see. Yes.
Yeah. It is sometimes really strikingly different. So let's go ahead and just let's run down this list. And again, this list is, this is part of my conference, Early Speech Language Development, Taking Theory to the Floor. There's also a modified list or kind of a way to address these things in my latest therapy manual, Teach Me to Talk, the therapy manual. So if you need written background, written information, you want to take a look at that, that's the source that I'm using on this. But for the key social skills list, I always start, number one, with the child's ability to want to be with you. And again, I try to look at all of these social skills from a quantitative perspective, meaning how often does he do it? How consistent is it? You know, when we're referring to quantity, we mean, again, a number. And again, there is no norm for a child should want to be with you X amount of times in a day. However, when you have a child who doesn't ever want to be with you or who rarely wants to be with you. And again, sometimes I'm not even talking about that connection that a child with social skills might have with his mom, because sometimes those children seem to almost be hyper-connected to their mothers, and we've talked about this on the show before and how sometimes that connection is there. And again, a mom might not be able to objectively look at how a child interacts socially because she feels so emotionally connected to her sweet baby that she doesn't see that he doesn't really interact with anyone else, or even with her, that there might be a quantitative difference, meaning that he's only with her or only is truly connected to her maybe at night when they are snuggling to go to sleep, or when he's really hurt, or if he's overstimulated and she has become his regulatory object, for lack of a better term there. And again, moms sometimes don't see that. But again, talking about the child's ability to want to be with you, it should be consistent, meaning that there are lots of times throughout the day that he comes to you, that he approaches you, that he initiates interaction with you. Certainly as a therapist looking at this skill, it should be that you don't have to, and I always say this in the conference, be in a kid's home and break out in a sweat, standing on your head, you know, doing every fun thing that you can imagine, you know, for 45 minutes before you really feel like you have gotten him to want to be with you. And that would be a quantitative difference. It didn't happen as often as you would want or as quickly, and I think I kind of refer to that as a qualitative difference, as you would want it to happen. You know, and we've talked about this a lot on the show, that children have to be, want to be with other people and connect with other people and have a reason to communicate with other people first before they're really developmentally ready to talk. And if you have to spend so much of your time and energy wooing that child into participating with you and playing with you and connecting with you, you know, that should be your number one goal. But you need to know when you're doing that, when it takes that much time and effort, that that's atypical development, because typically developing children want to be with other people. Kate, you always contrast delayed children and children who are communicatively and socially not developing like we would want them to, in striking contrast to children who are typically developing, because you always describe those kids as demanding, mm-hmm. and really working to get their mom's attention. You know, all the times that we've talked about that, and I always say, you know, with typically developing kids, a mom can barely go to the bathroom because
I think it's usually my actual children that I'm using as my frame of reference.
Yeah.
But it is true. I mean, it is that typically developing kids, you know, there's certainly some variance among typical, but most typically developing kids, they would be happy to be the center of their mother's attention all day, every day. That's a fact. Listen to me. Let me do this trick for you. Let me show you this. Look at me. You know, it's all about them, and that's very normal for a two-year-old child. And they do pretty much demand it to one degree or another. Some kids do it more gracefully than others, but they pretty much, and, you know, for some of our kids who aren't typically developing, you know, it kind of breaks our hearts to see how easily they can be left in a room alone, how easily they can be corralled in the kid corral and left with the TV on, and they're perfectly happy, content anyway. And parents who don't have more experience with typically developing kids, maybe it's their first child, they don't know that typically developing kids just will not be left. I don't care what cool cartoon you put on, maybe for a little while, 5 minutes, but, you know, I always joke about the playpen being a total wasted investment in my house because I couldn't put my kids in there without them screaming their heads off. So I consequently did not use the playpen for my children because they didn't allow it. And I think that's really, really typical. Some kids are more demanding than others, for sure, even typically among typically developing kids. But kids whose social skills are not typical and they don't demand more attention are oftentimes kind of considered easy children.
Uh-huh.
And in a way, they are rather easy because they may demand to have their basic needs met. They may demand something to drink or something to eat, or maybe change the channel, I want to watch a different show, or whatever it is, whether they do it verbally or not. But they do not demand attention, attention, attention. Look at me, watch me, aren't I wonderful? They don't seem to have that intrinsic need for that. So, therefore,
they don't
demand it.
Yeah, and I think they don't spend as much of their day paying attention to other people.
No.
Our kids who are developmentally delayed often amuse themselves or engage in things that aren't related to interacting with people. And even sometimes, and again, this is kind of a qualitative difference, even when you see them sometimes approach their mothers, it's just to grab their legs or to kind of stand there and let their moms hold them and hug them and do all those things. And to me, or even sometimes they may burrow themselves in their mom's laps, but again, it's not in the social way where they're taking their mommy's heads and turning their mommy's heads to look at them and to make their moms pay attention to them. They almost kind of burrow in backwards sometimes. And again, there's great variability even among children who have social issues who will likely go on to be diagnosed with autism. There are different levels, and again, that's why we call it a spectrum disorder, of how connected they are to other people, especially their primary caregivers. But sometimes even when a mom is telling me how social her kid is and how connected he is to her, I can still really look at how he interacts with her and still say, gosh, there's some degree of atypicalness about even when he's most connected. Do you know what I'm trying to say with that? You can still look, even at that time when she's saying, I hope he's so snuggly with me, still that even if he is somewhat affectionate, there's still a qualitative difference. You know, it's still just not the same as a child who is not struggling socially.
Right. I mean, I think that calling it a qualitative difference to me makes sense, but that's what I see most often is those kids who really are not socially connected in a typical way. They may be very likely to go and do that snuggling. They rub in their mom's, you know, they snuggle into their mom's lap and they want to be snuggled real tight. Sometimes you'll see them petting on their mommy's hair. There's a real physical need there, but it's really not what I think of as being intrinsically social. They don't really,
right.
They're not looking at their moms per se. They're not really asking to have their mommies watch them do anything, or it's just physical needs being met, which is, you know, all kids do that, but that tends to be all they demand from their mommies.
Right.
That physical
exactly.
feedback. Yeah, give me the snuggles. And there's a lot to be said for that, but it's not the same as a typical child.
Right.
A typical child wants that, but they also want mommy really watching and really attending to what they're doing and really responding, and they're looking for the
yeah.
response, and they're pretty much demanding, or they're certainly going for the response. You know, they're
right.
going to do everything they can to keep mommy watching and enthusiastic mm-hmm. about what they're doing.
Right.
And it's not
right.
what you see with kids with social delays. They want the physical stuff. They don't really care about the attention all that much.
Right. I think that's a great way to put it. And lots what I really look for and what I listen for when moms are talking about their own children, they might say, oh, he pretty much ignores other people, or he likes mm-hmm. doing his own thing, or he doesn't really care about playing with his brothers and sisters unless they are, and they may say XYZ, you know, doing something that's just really a preferred activity. Usually that's either movement-based, meaning that they're
right.
tickling and roughhousing or something.
Running
or
outside or...
Yeah. Or she may say he really likes bath time with his brother. And really, if you know, and again, we don't take baths during speech therapy. I don't really know what goes on, but I think that it's just they're enjoying the water and enjoying, again, the gross motor part of that versus that true emotional connection there. So, again, I like to try to think about it in terms of quantitative difference, meaning how consistently does that happen, and even a qualitative difference. Does it look exactly like you would expect it to look? And I love what you said before about sometimes a mom's point of reference. If she doesn't have lots of experience with other children, if he's her first child, I always tell therapists during the conferences that I do, that kid is that mom's normal. She doesn't really truly know anything else. And I've joked about this a lot with, you know, our oldest son who has some sensory issues and had some quirks. You know, he's 22 now and doing great. But I really didn't realize how, because he was my first experience to parent, I didn't realize some of his issues were issues until I had really typically developing baby number two. And so, again, some of the things that I would have thought were really kind of normal and expected, because he was my, you know, not my first professional reference, but my first personal reference with my only child, it was really kind of shocking to have that second kid and go, huh, wow, teaching him learning how to do this or this experience, gosh, that was pretty easy
mm-hmm.
compared to some of the things with Jonathan. And again, he was my first kid. And so even if I knew, it's just totally different when you parent a child versus when you have professional interactions with the child. And haven't we kind of joked about some of our therapist buddies who were young and who didn't have any kids, and we would say, yeah, wait till she has a baby, uh-huh. You know, I kind of laughed about that because your practice changes. Your whole kind of point of reference changes once you parent a child. And if any of you therapists are listening to me who don't have children and who were suddenly feeling very offended, sorry about that. Yes, yeah, sensitive. Sorry about that, but it's just how I really feel about it. It's totally the game. It's the game changer when you become a mom and really live with a kid. Live it, you know, the whole 24/7. And so my point about this is, if a mom has not had other children with which to compare, or even if she has, you know, we all try to, as parents, look at our own children's individual differences and assign a lot of things to temperament differences or personality differences or even kind of family traits, when really it could be there's some atypicalness mixed in and that we haven't quite wanted to label it what it truly is, you know, for whatever reason. So, and I think sometimes young therapists, because they haven't been moms yet or because they haven't seen hundreds of children yet, are a little bit reluctant to call some of these social things what they really are and to say, gosh, that's a true difference in development versus, you know, and a more experienced therapist, you might come in right away and go, whoa, we have got some talking to do about this. You know, this is a problem. So
kind of concerned about this particular thing. Well, yeah. And Laura, the other place that we see this happen a lot as far as therapists who, and this is not bash therapists who don't have kids. We all started out without kids. Nobody's born
exactly.
with them. So
we
all did
right.
that as we got older
right.
or chose not to, and that's fine. But and I think this happens with therapists with kids as well. It's been kind of in our minds lately because we've had a couple of situations where it's kind of come up and we've talked about it, not on the podcast, but where kids, you know, their behaviors are different. And by different, I don't mean good. You know, they tend to have lots of volatile outbursts, or I'm dealing with somebody right now who's a thrower, throws things constantly, and therapists will sometimes basically can attribute that to parenting, you know, like, gee, mom just didn't teach them not to throw the cup, or
right.
They don't have any discipline in the house, and so the child's having all these behavioral issues, and I always, you know, I mean, sometimes there is some merit to that, but oftentimes, oh, let's say this. In these particular circumstances, they have been related to children who were not typically developing at all.
Right.
And they had a lot of issues. They had lots of sensory issues. They had lots of social issues. My heart breaks for the mom who's told repeatedly, basically, you're not parenting well, and look
right.
at your child's behavior as a result. And I'm thinking, that's not really fair, you know, as
right.
a parent
yeah.
of two supposedly typically developing kids. Even among typically developing kids, you have your easier kids and your more difficult kids. But
mm-hmm.
for sure, when you factor in kids who are not typically developing, their language is delayed, their social skills are delayed, they have lots of sensory issues. These are kids who tend to have some more extreme behaviors. And I just...
Right.
It really bothers me to hear a mother being told basically she's not parenting well when, you know, I think anybody would be challenged with a child, you know, with these particular kids because they have some very real things going on that are contributing to the behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that there aren't some behavioral interventions that wouldn't be helpful, but it's not because mom forgot to mention don't throw the cup, you know.
Right.
It's really
and
not
I think
that
that's
simple.
A great point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great point because a lot of our moms are. They're already so internally feel so responsible that
right.
something they could have done caused these things when, I mean, I think both you and I go to great lengths to say, he's wired differently, you know, and if a mom is ready to hear it, you know, he has some real neurological differences here. There's not anything that you have done that's made this what it is. And again, it's not that sometimes behavioral interventions won't make it better. I just
right.
think it is very validating to say to my mom, this is not your fault. So
right.
quit feeling guilty about that or listening.
Not, it isn't. I mean, these are kids who
right.
have significant things in multiple areas of development. And,
right.
and it's not uncommon for therapists sometimes to just kind of basically say, well, you need some rules around here. And it's like, rules? You know?
Yeah. And you want to say, okay, you're staying for an hour and you're not getting much better, and let's add 23 hours to that. And oh, yeah,
yeah.
Let's try 7 days a week and see how you would be.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah. These are not always easy kids. They can have a
right.
lot of issues. So, anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. That's a great point.
If you're a mom listening, we feel your pain. We know it's not you. So, we'd love
totally.
To, you know, there's probably some
yeah.
things you can do that will help. But some kids are harder than others. That's the truth.
That is the truth. All right, so that was our first thing. We better get going because we got 25 more minutes to talk about
okay.
the whole rest of this list. Okay, that was the first thing that we want to see is a child who wants to be with other people, who is engaged. You know, we call that engagement, meaning that he wants to be with you. You don't have to work a long time. He pays attention to other people regularly and consistently. And, again, the people part is the big clue there, not just things. People. He likes people. He wants to be with people, and not just one person or two. It's lots of people. So it's how you're looking at that. Okay, the second key social skill there is an ability to make and maintain eye contact. And we have talked about this a lot. We're not going to spend, you know, 30 minutes on this or anything, but just when we're looking at a child, and again, we're using these words quantitatively and qualitatively. Does he look at you more than just a couple of times in a 15-minute play period? If he's not looking at you intently, that's usually a problem. If he's not looking at you, you know, checking out the toy and then looking back at you and, you know, looking at you from across the room, looking at you when he's right in front of your face, and again, looking at your eyes, not just staring at your mouth moving, which happens with a lot of our little guys in therapy. They'll look at your mouth, and moms will usually say, oh, gosh, he's watching your mouth. He's trying to figure out what you're saying with your mouth. And I'm thinking, nope, that's not it. He's not really looking at, you know, he is really visually fixated on that part of me that is moving 90 miles an hour, since I usually talk a lot and talk fast. And, you know, haven't you seen kids like that, Kate, that never really look up at your eyes? They're just totally staring at your mouth the whole time. And
yes.
I think, yeah, that's not normal. And
no.
again, if you're a therapist, you may never have heard that before, but start paying attention to that. Or if a kid, and again, we're going to talk about this in a second when we talk about joint attention, but once you hold up a choice for them to make, they're looking at the toy, and I call it the radar vision. They are locked in on looking at that toy or that visual choice, and they never then glance back at your face. When you are saying, is this what you want? Cookies, cookies, cookies. They are just totally focused on that darn bag of cookies, and then never give your face another look or your eyes. And so I think that's, again, a qualitative difference and a quantitative difference. He doesn't do it consistently, and he might look at you in a fleeting manner, always joke in the conference and say that someone might say, oh, he looks at me out of the corner of his eyes as he runs by me. You know, that's not eye contact. That's not what we want to see with that. We want to see that eager and expectant look. We always talk about twinkly eyes on here. Kate, you talk about that almost every show. You say that at least one time. You know, I want him to twinkle. I want him to really, really, really light up. And that's what we're talking about. And I love it when I've worked with the kid who doesn't have that, and then we get it. And I always use that opportunity to say to mom, there it is, look, look, that's what we want. That's what I'm talking about. We want him totally looking at me and totally, you know, his whole little body, he lit up right now. Did you see that? And sometimes moms haven't really noticed that difference, or they don't know that typically developing kids do that a lot. And when I'm working with a kid who's not on the spectrum versus is on the spectrum, even a child who might be language delayed, who's just not talking but has great social skills, will still be so totally into me and what we're doing, and will just pretty much look like that almost a whole darn hour, because that's, again, typical development versus atypical development. So with eye contact, you really want to look at how often it happens, qualitatively, how it looks, if a kid has fleeting eye contact, if he avoids eye contact. We certainly have all worked with children like that. Have you had children, Kate, that who seem to do everything they could except look right at you?
No, I never.
That's not what you're supposed to say.
Yes, I have, of course. Yeah, and I guess that's the thing about the eye contact that I just want to go on record as saying. A lot of times when you see that avoidance, it is when you're in very close proximity to the child. Those kids seem to be a little less threatened by that direct eye contact from a distance. It's kind of when you're sitting on the floor with them and you've got this cool toy and you're trying to engage them socially and they're locked into the toy. And you're doing, I mean, I hunch over, I'll put a toy up on a table, anything I can do to try and get them at my eye level to encourage that. And some kids, it's almost impossible. I mean, even if you hold their little faces in a loving way and say, oh, and you're trying to get them, they still avert their eyes to the side. It's like they, you know, they won't allow.
Avoid.
Yes, and it is when you're closest to them that it's most dramatic, that they're really avoiding it. Sometimes those same kids from a distance will kind of look you in the eye but that real close proximity, which normal kids, typical developing kids, are pretty comfortable with that. You know, that's not a threat to them. If you're close there and you're talking and you're being cute and funny, they're going to look you in the eye and twinkle right along as you do it. But with kids with social issues, a lot of times the eye contact is somehow, it almost seems like it's threatening to them. I guess I'm just reading that into it. For whatever it is, they certainly avoid it actively.
And they look right past you or almost right through you sometimes is how, again, you can describe it if you've never really noticed that or you're not, you know, you're really not an experienced therapist yet. That's how it feels like too. Sometimes, gosh, he is looking right past me. He is looking right through me.
Yeah, you think maybe they're looking at you, and then you kind of look and you go, nope, they're looking through me. You know, it's like their eyes are in the right direction, but they're not responding to what you're saying. They're not responding to your facial expressions. And you know, I've even taken my hand and kind of waved it in front to see
me
if they blink or that. Nope. When they get
nothing.
That far away look, no. You've lost
a dazed kind of look.
Yeah.
And so we talked about, we forgot to talk about this at the beginning, about that we want to be sure that we're talking about intervention-wise what we would do to work on that, and you've already mentioned that. We hunch over. We put the toy right by our eyes. If I have a toy on a table, boy, I put my head down on the table too to see if you can get some eye contact that way. If I do things that I know that they like, that they've thought have been funny in the past, I'll try to redo that. If I have a kid that I know likes music, I sing to them to see if I can get some eye contact. If I have a kid that I know likes tickling, I will tickle them to try to get some eye contact. If there's a kid, again, who likes to bounce or, you know, any kind of little movement thing, those are the interventions that you do. You figure out what the kid likes to do, and you do that while you're being fun. And, again, we use affectionate and loving because that's how you connect with children. We talked about that on the show before, too, about not being afraid to be very nurturing and very physically affectionate, meaning holding children and putting, you know, putting them on your laps and really, really close to them. I get right in those kids' faces if I think that they'll let me and if I think that, gosh, I'm doing something that he's going to like. You know, that's what will, that's when we're trying to get eye contact and really make that meaningful for them. And if you have a kid that that it seems like it's threatening for, you may not do that, you know, right away. You're going to work your way up to that. But you certainly want to build on those positive experiences so that they can look at you. And I always say, when I feel like I've gotten that, sometimes for the first time with the kid, whether I've seen him, it's happened the first day, or for some kids it really is oftentimes several weeks into therapy. When you finally get that moment, to me, you know, it feels like, oh, you know, like heaven's opened up and I can hear the angels sing, hallelujah, we are getting somewhere. Because sometimes you haven't had that kind of close feeling. And I, you know, I always think about a kid like that, it makes me feel warm and fuzzy. And I think that's how he looks right now. He looks warm and fuzzy. Like, you know, gosh, that was cool. I like you. I like doing this. This is fun. So that's what we're going for when we're working on eye contact. And again, doing something the kid likes is much more likely to facilitate that eye contact and entice that kid to be more comfortable with you so that he does feel less threatened or pressured, or sensory-wise, he's gotten himself in a better place so that he can look at you and engage with you better. Do you want to say any more about eye contact there, Kate?
No, I think you alluded to this. I guess I'll just add that vocally, I know you said you sing and all that. We do a lot of vocal weird stuff, whether it be, you know, do a high voice, do a low voice, do one of those big gasps that you use a lot. I use them quite a bit too. You know, all those little quirky kind of weird things that kids kind of like, even a kid who has some social issues, and that's why we do them. You know, that's why we use the sing-song voice. That's why we... whatever, all the little things that we do help a kid to, we hope, and normally they do, to attend better, to look at you more often, to be more responsive. We're trying to get them all those things, and eye contact is certainly one of them. Anything you can get them to do to look you in the face, to look you in the eye, is a good thing. So I guess
exactly. Yeah, and we get I mentioned the bouncing or something, but a lot of times it's during a physical movement game. It's when you're picking them up and swinging them around, or if you're using a blanket and you're working on swinging that way. So many times, don't we see kids who really are pretty disconnected most of the time while you're swinging them in that blanket and singing or counting or whatever. You know, whatever little social routine you're developing, that's when you're going to get the most eye contact, when their little bodies are doing something they like. So you purposefully introduce that and do that. Jumping on a trampoline or jumping on the bed or on the couch or even on the floor, that may be when you get better eye contact than just playing with a toy or just talking to them. You know, do introduce some of that movement, and particularly something that they, you know, that they like, because you'll get eye contact better in that situation. Okay, the next skill that we analyze and that we want to look at is joint attention. And again, we've talked a lot about attention on the show. I know that back in the summer, we did a whole show about how to entice attention with using activities that a child likes. But sometimes when we talk about joint attention, we don't clearly explain that to moms, and they'll say something like, well, his attention is great with his favorite television show. And I always joke in the conference that a mom will say, he can watch TV for 6 hours straight. And usually it's not the attention part, it's shifting attention. And again, the joint attention part means that when you have a toy or when you're sharing a cool activity, he can look at you, look back at the toy, look back at you, look back at the toy, look at his mom, look back at the toy. Again, eye contact plays a part of this, and wanting to be with you plays a part of this. It's not Again, some of these social skills aren't, you can't really isolate it to one particular action. You know, it kind of all builds on each other. But joint attention is part of that, where you're sharing the experience. If you are bringing out a toy and you suddenly disappear, the kid never looks at you again, he is hyper-focused on the toy, he does not have joint attention. It's the shifting his focus and his gaze and his ability to be able to attend to both things equally, meaning you and what you're doing, is what is how you quantify that and how you qualify it. You know, he's got to have both, and he's got to look at you more than just at the very beginning. You can't just totally disappear once the activity begins. So, again, sometimes we don't explain that to parents in a way that they can really, really understand it. And so when I finally get that in a session, I like to say to moms, here it is. Did you see? He looked at
joint attention. Yeah, I always think, you know, in the beginning with kids where it's not a strength or you don't see it at all, typically in the beginning you see it with something that's kind of somehow kind of exciting, whether it be, you know, you're blowing bubbles and you pop a big one and it pops him in the face and he looks at you, or you're blowing up balloons and it shoots across the room with a big whirlwind and the kid looks at you and kind of twinkles at you like, oh, look what you did. And then he looks back at the balloon. You know, it's usually that's where you see it in the beginning with a kid, you know, where he doesn't really have that, is some exciting thing. And he looks at you as if to say, wow, that was cool, do it again. You know, it's very communicative. And you know it when you see it. And some kids in the beginning who have social issues, you don't really see it at all. They may love the balloon that flew across the room, but there's no connection back to you, whether they're aware of the fact that you shot it or not. They may go get the balloon, stick it in your hand to do it again, but they're not looking at you, they're not real. It's just using you as a means to an end, and there's really no social connection over it.
Right.
So,
right.
Anyway.
And so when we work on joint attention, you do the same thing that we just talked about with eye contact. You use activities that they like and that they light up about. But you do everything you can to help the child notice that you are part of that. And you mentioned before, Kate, those silly little noises that you can do to be a part of the activity, you know, whether it's saying woohoo or, you know, wee, or any of those little exclamatory words can help do that. Sometimes it's just, if I see a kid really lighting up, looking at a bubble or a balloon, don't you try to jump where he's looking? I find myself doing that all the time. I think, oh, he's looking just to the right of me. Oh, I'm scooting over there so he can see me. You know, it's just that shift. I'll think, can I catch him? Will he look at me like that? And so, again, that's what you do to facilitate that. Sometimes with joint attention, if you're really working on that, you can't use their very favorite thing. Like if I know a child is really, really so entranced when we play trains so that he can only watch the wheels, he has to, you know, lie down on the floor and put his face right by the tracks. Sometimes I think, gosh, I'm really not going to play that. I'm going to work on joint attention in maybe an activity that is visually enticing, but not as enticing as those darn train wheels. Because, again, you almost guarantee with some of those activities that you're left out. And not to say that you don't want to do things the kid likes, but sometimes haven't you had situations, Kate, where you think, well, I'm not going to play that because once I bring that out, it is over. He is done with me. It's all about whatever
all
that
too often.
Is.
And sometimes I had it happen the other day where I had trucks and cars out, and this kid is liking that. He's kind of grown into that. And initially it was a good shared thing, and he was like using some words, which is huge for him, and it was going well, but he has a tendency to try and get whatever it is and then kind of shut me out, and that happened. And at that point I let it go for a minute or two, and when a kid's totally shutting me out, and by that I mean, you know, he's got his back to me, he's trying to play with things.
He's hunkered down, that's what I say.
Yeah, he's hunkered down, he's, you know, forget it, he has cut me out of the equation. That's when I say, okay, we're done with that. And I knew in this case it was going to elicit a negative response, but it was like, no, I let him do it a little bit, and then I had to clean him up, and we thankfully now I have a number of things I know he likes, but I moved on to something that was inherently more social that he needed me to be a part of, because if it's something they can do by themselves and that's their inclination, is to be kind of exclusive in their play and to shut out their play partner, whether that be another child or a therapist, in this case it was me, then we're done with that activity. And I'll avoid that to the extent that, you know, if I may try it again, but I'm going to shut it down when I see, okay, he's cut me out. I'm done. You know, I mean,
lost its therapeutic purpose.
Right.
Yeah.
Did he still like it? You bet. He was totally into it. But he was trying to put him, he has a thing about lining things up, and he was putting them on the TV card. And, you know, initially we were playing with them, and then he got kind of into his, I'm going to line them up and turn my back on you. And try as I may to get back into the equation, it just wasn't working. And I thought, well, okay, that's it for the cars and the trucks. And away they went. He got upset, but, you know, we moved on and it was okay.
But then he moved on, yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing that I want to bring up there is a lot of therapists will miss this and they'll say, well, he really likes it, so I'm quote-unquote following his lead.
Right.
And they'll stay there at that point, and they might have done that whole mindless narration where they say, car, go car, blue car, oh, car, ooh, fast car. If he is not looking at you and letting you be a part of that, again, that's mindless narration. There might be a little bit of language benefit to that, but more often than not, you are the same as the dryer or the doorbell, probably less alerting than the doorbell,
yes.
Your background noise.
I think that happens quite a bit. I think that therapists don't necessarily get that sometimes, and I have to admit, I knew when I saw him do it, I let it go for a couple minutes, and I tried to get back in, and it wasn't happening, and I knew darn well, when I put these away, he's going to hit the wall. And I knew it, and I just steeled myself for the reaction, which I got. Luckily, like I said, I knew I could go get something else that would win them back, and it did. But I think a lot of times therapists, particularly those less seasoned therapists, they know the kid's going to be mad. And it is kind of intimidating to know, okay, well, he's shut me out. That means we got to be done with this, even if he's loving it. And you got to, you know, take them away from, I mean, it's kind of, and I think when I hear parents tell me about therapists that their kids are not responding to, that's typically the formula. The kid is a highly spirited kid who throws fits when he gets upset. The therapist has something they like. They get the thing. They shut the therapist out of the play. And that's pretty much the end of the session. After, you know, once he did that
or
to me,
the therapist might say 40 more minutes and call it therapy, but she's not doing much of anything. Not really, except just
off
to flapping
the side,
her jaws in
saying,
the wind.
Go car, get the truck. Oh, truck, go. And see, my thing was I knew, oh, well, this is done. I'm going to have to get ready for the fit. And I did, and I knew he was going to throw it. He did, but it was no big deal. But I think therapists who haven't done it very long, and one, either they don't recognize they've been cut out of the equation, or
therapists who've done it like that for 20 years.
Right. it's not always a question of seasoning, but you're right. I mean, some people just may not even recognize, or I don't know, maybe they don't care. But for us, you know, we're thinking we've got 60 minutes.
Yeah.
We've got to make it count. I'll give them a minute or two of that. And that's when I say, okay, all done, clean up. I knew he was going to throw a fit. He did.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes they either don't recognize it or they don't care, or they recognize it and they're fearful of the reaction they're going to get when they clean it up. And that's why you have to have an arsenal of things that kids like.
A backup
plan.
Yes,
you've got to be able to get them onto something else. And that's when I tend to do more social, more movement kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's when we're going to blow bubbles. That's when we're going to...
Yeah. Or eat. That's when I'll do a snack. If I know they really like a snack that I have in my bag, that's a good time to introduce that. The social thing. Sometimes if I think the kid's going to cry, I'll say to mom, okay, I'm going to put this up. I know what's coming, and you know what's coming, and it's okay. We're going to work through this.
Right.
So that
Which
they
I kind of said to the dad. Here we go.
Yeah.
I knew he was going to. That's
right.
His M.O., and that's okay. I'm not saying
right.
I like it when kids cry. I hate it when
right.
kids cry, but there
yeah.
are situations that you know, and that has worked for him. I mean, he does pretty much get to do what he wants to do because people are on eggshells about it, and I'm kind of like, nope, I'm not. I'll give you a couple minutes, and then you're going.
Right.
You will allow me to be part of the play formula here, or
mm-hmm.
we're not playing. And I do think that
right.
kids have to know that. I mean, with a therapist,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
I'll bend over backwards to keep it pleasant, to keep the kid happy, to keep the kid engaged. You know, all those things. However, I'm going to be part of it. I don't just hand them a toy and say, have fun, I hope you like the toy, and I'll sit back and watch you play with it and or not, or do whatever you're going to do, and I'll just mindlessly narrate as you're going to. I mean, I think that forcing them to engage in the most positive
mm-hmm.
of ways is critically
right.
important to a truly therapeutic session, and that doesn't happen too much of the time, you know, with some therapists.
Well, I like what you always say about this, and you haven't said it yet. I've been waiting on you to say it, so I'm going to say it. You always say, you want the kid to learn, Kate comes with the toy. Once you leave me out, you do not get that toy anymore. We are moving on to something else. And that is a good way to think about it when they start to shut you down. If you can't get back in, if it's the toy is so enticing for whatever reason, whatever sensory property, whatever sensory difference he has going on, then that is not a toy you're going to be able to use in therapy on that particular day. Now, the next week it might be different. It, you know, he might not get to play with it for several weeks or months until he matures a little bit, but that's just how it is. When
right. Or
you
I
can't
may
play,
figure out a way to try and
yeah.
minimize that tendency of shut me out, because lots of kids, that's, you know, that's kids with social issues, that's what they do. That's what they're
right.
good at, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's so they.
That's why you're there for
that's
therapy.
That's why I'm there. Yeah, they have lots of ways of doing that. And you're right,
no.
that is one of my, I forget my standard lines. I do come with the toys. I'm the
yeah.
necessary evil. And,
right.
you know, sometimes it starts out good like that with that scenario, and then it was clear he was done with me, and then
right.
we were done with that toy, because I just don't allow kids to do that for more than a couple minutes. And I
yeah,
do think
and again,
once kids know that, once you've established
yeah.
that with kids, those
it
are the kids that mom say to you, he likes you better than anybody else, he'll play with you, and partly it's because, yeah, he has to. I mean, you know,
right.
because
there is
I have
no
never,
other choice. Yeah,
yeah, and I'm glad that parents don't necessarily recognize that.
Right,
it's not like
right.
I stand there and say, you will play with me or else. But I
right.
have set the stage from day one, as you do, Laura, to mm-hmm. teach the child. I do come with the toys. I do expect
right.
some social engagement. And if I don't
right.
get it, we're done with that toy. It's really that
exactly.
simple. Yeah.
Well, then it's not a therapy tool anymore. And if it's not
no.
a tool for you to use in therapy, it's, you know, chunk it. Move on to the next tool. That's all our toys
right.
really are. It's
right.
a way to teach kids how to engage, how to play in a more mature way, how to climb to that next rung up the developmental ladder, how to work on that next little language thing. And if you have a tool that's not effective, don't use it, or make yourself, you know, keep flipping through that big file cabinet in your brain and come up with a new idea of how to use the toy more effectively or how you can engage. And for some kids, it's that you might be able to play with that kind of toy with better results at the beginning of a session versus the end of a session. For some kids, it's
right.
opposite. You almost have to work them up, and they can do it at the end because socially, you know, you've gotten them ready, you've gotten them more regulated, they can let you in. And so it's different for every kid. And again, that's what makes this job so exciting, is that it's not a cookbook. You have to have real clinical judgment. You have to be on your toes And I think that's what separates a really skilled therapist from one who's not so skilled. And, you know, thank goodness we have reasons to get up in the morning when we, you know, have, you know, that whole investigative process. I think that's why I like this job so much, because it isn't just you do X and you always get Y. You know, it's and even in the same kid, it doesn't always work on that. Because you could go this next week with that kid and take that and it'd be a totally different situation.
Right.
Perhaps, or maybe he needs 6 or 8 more weeks of intervention before you would see that different scenario.
I mean, I will say, I think that's true of kids with social issues, and particularly kids who are on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. How often mm-hmm. have you seen a kid that you thought, oh, he loved this today. He did so well with it. And you might get 1 or 2 weeks, more weeks out of it, or maybe no more weeks out of it. I mean, the very next week, you bring the same toy that they loved and didn't work at all. You know,
the next 5 minutes could be that way. It really could.
Really?
And again, that's
you're thinking
the
you
nature.
Have a dead ringer. It's 100% sure thing, and nope, he never cares about it again. Like, that's why we have so many toys, is because
you have options.
They change their minds. Yes.
Right. Oh. Right. Right, and that's why we have more than one outfit in the closet, too. We're kind of like that as well. So,
true.
There you go. Well, ended with a reference to clothes. How about that?
Gosh, we're over time already.
We're over, I know. So this week we talked about wanting to be with other people, eye contact, joint attention, what that looks like when we're analyzing it from a qualitative and a quantitative perspective. And we got through 3 of those skills, and so next week we're going to talk about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 more skills that children have to have socially before they're really developmentally ready to learn language or to serve as the foundation for language development. So we'll have part 2. If I know us, Kate, this may be a 3 or 4-part series. Who knew we would be able to drag this out like this? Anybody that listens is probably thinking, I don't know how you didn't know this is going to take more than one show. You and Kate can barely talk about anything for... Takes a little while. Anyway, all right. Any parting words, Kate?
Have a great time in Indianapolis. I know that's always been a great place for you to go. Near and dear to my heart. Tell the Hoosiers I said hello. I think we're...
And we'll just pick up here next week with part 2 of this show about social skills in toddlers. Thanks for listening. Thanks for joining us.
Sounds good. Thanks, Laura.
All right. Bye. Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.